explored what Jesus had to say about giving, praying, and fasting. And whilst there is much written about how we give and how we should pray, there's very little in the Bible about how or why we fast. But I want us to extend our thinking on fasting today. And we're going to be thinking about fasting as well next week as well. The reason why I want to carry on this thought about fasting is, first of all, because it's a neglected subject and I want to give time to it. But secondly, my intention is for us to encourage a time of prayer and also fasting during Lent this year. And over the coming days, hopefully I'll be able to communicate how I hope we'll be able to approach that. But today I want us to discover how fasting can help us stand firm in our Christian faith. And next week we'll see how fasting can help us corporately know God's direction for the future. In year 13, when I was in sixth form, we came to the end of our year. I think we'd done all of our preparation for our exams. We're about to go off on study leave for them. And as it was kind of the last time that we'd all be together, our year group of 180 students, we had an awards ceremony, which was mostly tongue-in-cheek, celebrating or highlighting certain people for certain things that they had done or what we thought that they might do in future. And I was given two awards myself. Most people didn't seem to get awards, but for some reason this award committee seemed to have me in mind for this event. And I was given two awards. Now, the first one, which I think was a nice one, I can't remember what it was, which is unfortunate, isn't it? But the second one, I certainly can. The second award that I was given was the student, out of the 180, to be the most likely to go off the rails at university. I assume it was all done in jest because I was quite a model student at school. And so whether they just saw a glint in my eye that something was going to go drastically wrong in my life, or whether it was just tongue-in-cheek, I'm not quite sure. You can make up your own minds, can't you? But it is true, isn't it, that many people, whether they've got faith or not, can go off the rails when they go to university. I was going to Google images for going off the rails at university and then put up an image, but then I thought the kind of images that we would get probably wouldn't be suitable for putting up this morning, so we got Thomas the Tank Engine instead. But it's true, isn't it? Maybe people in our own families or people that we know, or maybe when we finished school and went off to college or university or to work or something like that, we know people, or maybe it's a story of ourselves, of us going off the rails, of us kind of losing our moral compass, being caught up and being swept up in all of the different values that we experience when we go to in another place and forget about what our heart is saying to us and also what we should do. I didn't live up to the expectation of my 180 fellow students because I didn't go off the rails when I went to university. Instead, I kind of went the other direction. Before I went to university, I didn't really go to church, wasn't part of a church, didn't really know any Christians. But when I went to university, I decided to join a local Bible teaching church, and I joined the Christian Union as well. And that had a real impact on the way that I thought, but also on the ways in which I behaved as well. It was when I went to university where I started to think through more deeply about what it means to live a distinctively Christian life. I was around a certain group of friends, and from the church that I went to, from the CU that I went to as well, these things really helped me keep on the straight and narrow for my 3 years. Since leaving university, I've had my kind of my peaks and my troughs. I've had my good points and I've had my bad points as well. As my friendship groups have changed, as I've changed church a number of times as well. And because of all of that, and just through going through the process of life, my moral compass has changed at times. My moral red lines have moved. Where I've drawn a line in the moral sand has moved. My moral boundaries have changed over time. Sometimes for the good, but sometimes also, I have to admit, for the worse. Often, if you're a Jesus follower here today, often we are quite happy to talk about what life was like before we came to Christ, what our character used to be like before we met Jesus, maybe the kinds of things that we used to do or didn't used to do before we met Jesus. And then we can somehow make out that since that point, there's nothing else to say. That somehow, at the point of meeting Christ, all of our problems, all of our bad habits, all of our bad patterns in life have somehow been more or less sorted out, and there's nothing left to say. But I think all of us would have to confess that since the point that we have met Christ, not everything has been easy to figure out. And there have been times when we've made certain choices for the good or for the worse. I think maybe if we all went to, we all left this place and we all joined a monastery or we joined a convent and we became monks or nuns, then it would be very easy for us to live the good Christian life in inverted commas. Because we would find ourselves surrounded by people who would be encouraging us to live like Christ, to follow Christ in every day of our lives. And maybe we'd be more consistent in the choices that we made, and we'd be more intentional in the choices that we made as well. But the fact is, well, and hopefully not, hopefully we're not all going to join a monastery or a convent, because we are called to live in the world. We're not called, I don't believe, we're called to live separately from the world, although some people believe that they are called to do that. But I believe that all of us are called to be part of the world. We are called, for this time at least, to be shining the light and the revelation and the good news of Jesus Christ in Great Britain. And Great Britain is not like a monastery or a convent. There's always this ongoing debate, isn't there, about is Great Britain still a Christian country? And then every so often, certain politicians like to pipe up and start saying that it is. And just a few days ago, Damien Hines, who's the education secretary, said this: Britain still has at the core of its institutions traditions which are rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And that might be something that you agree with or disagree with. But then even if we look at politics, for example, of how within the central lobby of the Houses of Parliament, they do have scripture in the floor for people to be able to read. Even if before the House of Commons opens each day, prayers are said, even if at its core of our institutions there is a Christian message behind it, I think we would all have to say that within our broader culture, there isn't much of God in it. There isn't much encouragement in our general culture for us to be living lives for Christ. Rather, our culture, whichever way we look at it, promotes non-Christian values. We switch on our TVs without thinking about it, and we're given a worldview which is quite often not the same as what we would read in our Bibles. We can be watching TV shows, we can be watching movies, without even thinking about it, and they're telling us a story. They're telling us a set of values and principles and outlook on the world, which does not line up with our Bibles. We spend most of our time, I hope, in non-Christian contexts, where again, we're surrounded by people's opinions which are not encouraging us in our relationship with Christ and in following him. And over time, as we take in these different voices from all sorts of different directions, we can be highly influenced by them. And sometimes, if we don't remain strong in our faith, we can get swept away with the thought, the value system, and the morality of the culture that we find ourselves in. And so in a Christian context, sometimes we talk about something called backsliding. And we can have this image of someone falling down a slide, that somehow for us to be living a Christian life, we want to be living in an upward trajectory movement of faith, where as time goes along, we are growing in our dependence on God. We're loving more what God loves. We're hating more what God hates. And we're growing in our Christian maturity. But so often, when we're not pursuing that, and rather we're just listening to the voices of the world, and we're just living as the rest of the culture does, we can almost feel like we're starting to slide back down all of that journey and all of that progress that we are making in our Christian lives. Sometimes that backsliding can get to the point of being functional atheists. This is something that I've shared with you a couple of times before, because I think it's really important to get to grips with. This idea that we can have a Christian faith, we could sign up to a doctrinal basis of a church or of an organization. We can believe certain things, and yet when it actually comes to practicing out our Christian faith, we are more like an atheist than a Christian. I just had this image in my mind of, think of your neighbors. Say if you live in a semi-detached house, and you and your family claim to be Christians. Maybe you go to church 3 Sundays in 8. Maybe you occasionally read your Bible. Maybe you pray from time to time. And you definitely call yourself a Christian. How radically different does your life look to the people who live on the other side of that wall? Those people, your neighbors who might think of themselves as agnostics or atheists, if you were to compare the way that you lived your week with the way that they lived their week, would it actually be distinctively different? Or would it really more or less look like the same? If it does, then we could describe ourselves as functioning. Might be living like a Christian, but we're actually functioning like an atheist. And then if we give into the culture and we end up backsliding, we end up functioning like an atheist, then we can obviously get to the point of where we just start walking away from faith. And maybe there's some in this room who, for a time in your lives, have walked away from following Jesus. You've been following him, you've been pursuing him, you've been walking after him, you've been inspired by him. But culture has just kind of gradually changed your direction, and you just start walking away from where Jesus is going. And unfortunately, I think we probably all know people who are on that journey. This is something that we want to be avoiding, because we want to be pursuing Jesus. We want to be following Jesus, no matter what culture we have. People love to talk about the glory days, don't they? People love to talk about the 1950s. And about how we used to be a Christian country then, and it was so easy to be a Christian then, and there was more Christian morality around us. Well, we don't live in that time, and I'm not quite sure whether that time was really like that, or whether people look back on that time with rose-tinted glasses. But whatever culture we find ourselves in, we need to be intentional in following God. And so this morning we're going to see we're going to have a look at Daniel in the Old Testament, who was a young man who found himself in a very tricky, different, alternative, non-God-fearing culture. And we're going to see about how he used fasting in order to stand firm in his faith and progress in his faith as well. So I think Hilary is going to come up and read to us, and we're going to read together Daniel chapter 1.
Morning, everyone. I'm going to be reading from the New Living Translation, which will come up on the screen, hopefully. So this is first chapter of Daniel. Daniel in Nebuchadnezzar's court. During the third year of King Jehoiakim's reign in Judah, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave him victory over King Jehoiakim of Judah and permitted him to take some of the sacred objects from the temple of God. So Nebuchadnezzar took them back to the land of Babylonia and placed them in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, his chief of staff, to bring to the palace some of the young men of Judah's royal family and other noble families who had been brought to Babylon as captives. "Select only strong, healthy, and good-looking young men," he said. "Make sure they are well-versed in every branch of learning, are gifted with knowledge and good judgment, and are suited to serve in the royal palace. Train these young men in the language and literature of Babylon." The king assigned them a daily ration of food and wine from his own kitchens. They were to be trained for 3 years, and then they would enter royal service. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were four of the young men chosen, all from the tribe of Judah. The chief of staff renamed them with these Babylonian names. Daniel was called Belteshazzar, Hananiah was called Shadrach, Mishael was called Meshach, Azariah was called Abednego. But Daniel was determined not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to them by the king. He asked the chief of staff for permission not to eat these unacceptable foods. Now God had given the chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel. But he responded, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has ordered that you eat this food and wine. If you become pale and thin compared to the other youths of your age, I'm afraid the king will have me beheaded." Daniel spoke with the attendant who had been appointed by the chief of staff to look after Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. "Please test us for 10 days on a diet of vegetables and water," Daniel said. "At the end of the 10 days, see how we look compared to the other young men who are eating the king's food. Then make your decision in light of what you see." The attendant agreed to Daniel's suggestion and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his three friends looked healthier and better nourished than the young men who've been eating the food assigned by the king. So after that, the attendant fed them only vegetables instead of the food and wine provided for the others. God gave these four young men an unusual aptitude for understanding every aspect of literature and wisdom. And God gave Daniel the special ability to interpret the meanings of visions and dreams. When the training period ordered by the king was completed, the chief of staff brought all the young men to King Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and no one impressed him as much as Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the royal service. Whenever the king consulted them in any matter requiring wisdom and balanced judgment, he found them 10 times more capable than any of the magicians and enchanters in his entire kingdom. Daniel remained in the royal service until the first year of the reign of Cyrus, King Cyrus. May the Lord add his blessing to this reading.
So in the time of Daniel and his friends, politically there was a new superpower which was growing, which was the Babylonian Empire, and it was starting to cover its influence all over the Middle East. And those who were heading up this empire were wondering, how do we sustain this growth? We've oppressed so many nations, so many different people groups, so many different types of people. How are we going to control them so that they don't rise up and rebel against us? And so rather than trying to micromanage, what the Babylonian Empire did was they started to recruit the finest people in each of these nations that they had taken over. And they would bring them back to Babylonia, the kind of the hub of the empire, and they would teach them the ways and the values of Babylonian thought. They would do this for 3 years, and then they would send these people back to where they had come from, inspired in these new ways of thinking and leading. And then remotely, these people, these leaders, would lead these areas to be able to fulfill the desires of the Babylonian Empire. And so they would be bringing these people, as well as lots of riches as well from different places, and bringing them to the emperor, to the king. And so this is where we pick up the story, where we have four teenage boys or men, we could call them, from Jerusalem, who had been captured, selected because they had a lot of potential, because they looked healthy, because they were good looking, because they were intellectual, and they were brought to the king for them to be trained and discipled in the ways of this empire. And this meant that lots of changes had to happen in these young men's lives. It's likely that these four and many of the others that were brought to Babylonia would have only been perhaps 14 or 15 years old. They were taken away from their homes. They were taken away from everything that they knew, were planted in this foreign land, and were expected to live in a whole new different way. The Babylonians wanted these people to live a certain way, to think a different way, to become different people from who they actually were. And so in some ways, they tried to break them and mold them into who they wanted them to be. And so the first thing that they would do is they would give these new recruits, these new young students, new names. And so the chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. It wasn't unusual in these times for people's names to be changed. And throughout the scriptures, we see people being given new names when they have a new start with God. But in this case, it was a little bit different, because these young men had been born with Jewish names, names which meant something, to their faith and to their spirituality, to their heritage, which had been completely ripped away from them, and instead given new names, which then had connotations of Babylonian gods. They were then forced to learn the new language of the empire, forced to adopt new customs and to adopt new morals as well. They'd be taught about all of these other gods that the Babylonians sought to impress and win the favor, in the hope that these young men would forget who Yahweh was. And then, of course, as we see in our story, another way in which they tried to change these young Jewish men was through food. Now, these young men were broken in some ways, but in other ways they were encouraged, because these were going to be future leaders of different areas. And so the king wanted them to be healthy, to be intelligent, to be up for it at the beginning, but also throughout those 3 years to be prepared in a special way. And so for these students, they were offered food from the king's table. Now, you can imagine most students, perhaps not today, but certainly when I went to university, we never ate particularly well. And so it would have been a bit of a dream for us to be offered food from the king's own table and kitchen. The richest foods, the finest foods that had ever been known were offered to these young men. These young students would never eat super noodles again if they ate from the king's table. These young men were prepared to go along with what had been required of them. They accepted that they had new names. They were learning the new language. They were learning the new customs and the morals. But they weren't, in this case, prepared to start eating from the king's table. They were led by their conscience. Daniel and his friends purposed in their hearts that they would not defile themselves with a portion of the king's meat, nor the wine which he drank. Even though they were really young, even though they were 14, maybe 15 years old, even though they found themselves away from their families in a broken land, all of these new ideas and thoughts and perspectives being bombarded with, still they were able to listen to what was on the inside. They were still able to listen to their conscience, what was purposed on their hearts, and make a stand of what they were not prepared to do, which was to reject the king's food. And so they rejected what was on the table, what was prepared for them, and instead they had vegetables and they had water. Now, various theories have come up for why Daniel and his friends felt in their conscience and in their hearts that they weren't able to have the king's food, even though they were prepared to do all these other things. One suggestion is that if they were to eat from the king's table, they would be breaking Old Testament laws. That what the Babylonians ate and the meat that they ate was the type of food that a good Jewish boy wouldn't be eating. The Babylonians loved their pork, for example. And I read somewhere that they also liked horse, which is kind of interesting as well, isn't it? But also, it's not just the meat, but also the way that it was prepared as well. This food on the king's table wouldn't have been kosher food. But if that was the case, if that was the only reason why Daniel and his friends rejected food from the king's table, then why did they also reject the wine? Because the wine would have been fine for them to have drank. Another possibility is that all food that would have been brought to the king's table, before it came on a plate in front of him, it would have been offered to gods by his priests. And it was very clear that a good Jewish boy should not be eating food that had previously been offered to these gods. But then at the same time, that theory has a bit of a puncture in it as well, because not only was the meat and the wine offered, but also all the vegetables would have been as well, and the water. And yet Daniel and his friends ate vegetables and drank water, which would have been offered. So we can't be exactly sure. The Bible doesn't make it entirely clear why they were rejecting the king's food. But whatever the reason, for something within their own hearts, they made the conscious choice and decision not to eat from it. Eating the king's food would have been a step too far. This was their red line that they weren't prepared to go past. This was the line that they had drawn in the sand. Now, all of us remember when we were growing up, there would be certain things that we wouldn't like to eat. And there would be consequences for us refusing what our mums and dads have put in front of us. For some of us, if we refused to eat something, we just wouldn't get dessert at the end of it. I know someone who was brought up in a slightly stricter home who had to try something 3 times before they could say that they didn't like it and wouldn't eat it. And so on one occasion, at dinner time, she was given Stilton and broccoli soup as a child, and she didn't want to try it, and so she just refused to try it. She wouldn't even try it once, let alone 3 times. And so the punishment was that she could go away, but then as she came back in the morning for breakfast, what was in front of her? Not her Cocoa Pops, but a bowl of Stilton and broccoli soup. So that's a pretty harsh punishment, isn't it? But if you rejected what the king offered to you, and as we know, just in those times, really for many, many centuries all over the world, if you rejected what the king had offered to you, if you didn't do exactly as the king had ordered, you could easily be beheaded. Was this really a risk worth taking for Daniel and his friends? Wouldn't it have just been worth just going a little bit beyond that red line, going a bit beyond that mark that they had placed, that line that they had placed in the sand? Is it really worth losing your head just so that you don't have to eat some food that might have been offered to some idols or whatever their issue with it was? In this case, it was worth it. It was worth the ultimate risk of potentially losing your life, because it because if they had have done that, what else would they have compromised on? If they were willing to give in to that red line that they had set themselves, what would have become of their lives? What else would they have given into? It's been said this: if Daniel had not stood firm at this point, could he have possibly stood firm later when threatened with death in a lion's den? If his 3 companions had compromised in their early life, how would they have fared when faced by a burning, fiery furnace? It is because they honored God in a small thing that they were able to honor him when big issues were at stake. God worked in the heart of the king, and so the king agrees to this arrangement that these young men don't have to eat from his table, but they can just eat some vegetables and drink water. And after that, and after 10 days, this new diet had clearly made them healthier, and so they were allowed to carry on with this diet. God continued to work in their faithfulness. He continued to bless them. God gave these 4 young men an unusual aptitude for understanding every aspect of literature and wisdom. And God gave Daniel the special ability to interpret the meanings of visions and dreams. Because Daniel and his friends had been faithful in a small way, God opened that right up so that they lived lives full of purpose and meaning. Whoever we are, no matter what age we are, we're all easily influenced without realizing. How often do you come back into your house and you switch on the TV and you start watching something without ever really making a conscious decision that you're going to start watching TV? It's just a thing that happens. How often do you maybe just go to the newsagents and buy a particular paper, newspaper, bring it back and start reading it without thinking about how you might be influenced by that newspaper and by the editor? How often do we just start searching for stuff, looking on our regular websites, taking in lots of information, views and opinions without ever thinking, is this going to influence me? And do I want it to influence me? Daniel had made a red line to avoid backsliding. He knew that he needed to put certain choices, certain marks in place in the ways in which he lived to make sure that he wouldn't start backsliding or functioning like an atheist or a pagan in this case, or losing his faith. He needed that line. Today, what are the red lines that you have in your lives? It's not just, oh, I follow the Bible, but more specifically, as you live hour by hour, day by day, what are the red lines that you have purposefully put into your lives to make sure that you stand strong when you're tempted to do something else? What are the red lines that you had 10 years ago, or maybe longer ago, where they helped you stay strong in your faith, that you might have just started to blur or start to rub out or are now kind of pinky in color rather than red, that are less obvious now? What red lines might you need to implement in the future? As culture changes, as the voices that we hear change, how are we going to have certain red lines in the future to make sure that we stand firm in the ways in which we follow and worship God with our lives? Like I said last week, Jesus never gave specifics for fasting. He didn't say about the occasion, about the frequency, or the method. He never said about on what occasions and at what times we should be fasting. He never said you need to be fasting so many days a week or a month or a year. He never said about what method you should have in terms of your fasting as well. And we know there's all different kinds of ways in which we can fast, not just from food. He gives us that freedom, but within that freedom and Christian liberty, we need to take the impetus and we need to initiate good choices, good decisions for ourselves, as we know ourselves, of where we're going to put these red lines, where we're going to make a line in the sand. Personally, what could you fast from in order to keep standing firm and following Jesus? Daniel took the ultimate risk, didn't he, of maybe even losing his life for the sake of not breaking his red line. What risks are we prepared to make in order to continue standing firm in Jesus and following him? We have this phrase, FOMO, fear of missing out. And we have that fear that if we give up something that we really quite enjoy, even if it's for God, that somehow we're going to be missing out. Maybe you're thinking, you know what, maybe I could fast from food, but I don't want to miss out on some nice meals. It's not worth it. Maybe in terms of the films that we watch, we think, you know what, maybe I should have a red line and I shouldn't be watching this kind of film or that rating film, but then I'm going to be missing out on some good entertainment. I know someone who doesn't watch films that are about adultery. He's got a red line there. It's so easy just to start watching films, and with the way that the story is told, in some of these rom-coms in particular, you watch some of them and you see an unhappy woman married to a man, as the story unfolds, the woman becomes closer and closer with a man with another man, and because of the way that the story is being told, because you get so caught up in it and you're not aware of what you're thinking or what your values are, you end up hoping that the woman leaves her husband to be with this other guy. It's easily done. You easily get caught up in it. But is that actually a Christian value that we want to... Is that a value that we want to be adopting as our own? Because when we watch these films, when we watch these TV shows, they do have an influence on what we think is important and what we think is right. It's tempting to follow the latest trend, but sometimes these trends might be beyond a red line that we need. Sometimes we are so encouraged to accumulate wealth, to accumulate more, to accumulate more stuff. If we were to fast some of it, if we were to give up some of it, would that help us have less baggage in following Jesus? Just the other day, Justin Welby was speaking to the General Synod, and he suggested that the bishops and other people there for Lent might like to fast from cynicism. Maybe not just in our physical acts and in our routines, but also just in our attitudes and in our character. There are certain things which we should be fasting from, certain things which we should be giving up, certain qualities like cynicism and sarcasm, which are made to look so good and funny and popular on TV. But if we have that within ourselves, it's not going to help us follow Jesus. Maybe we need a red line there where we say we're not going to be sarcastic, we're not going to be cynical. The fact is that Daniel and his friends definitely did miss out on some good food. They must have missed out on a good number of steaks and all sorts of wonderful things. But I think it was probably worth it for him and for them, because God used the little that they gave up and made much out of their lives and made them very influential. If you're worried about missing out on something, if you're thinking, okay, maybe I shouldn't be watching this film, maybe I should give up that type of food, maybe I shouldn't be pursuing to have so much in my bank account, maybe I shouldn't be following this latest trend, you may have a fear that you're missing out on something. But what might God replace that with? How might God reward you, as we looked at the last few weeks? How might God reward you? How might God bless you? How might God use you in your openness to not be holding on to certain things, but to be giving them up, to have these red lines as we stand firm? My prayer for each of us is that we would be intentional in the choices that we make. That before we go to grab the TV remote, before we go to the news agents and buy a newspaper, before we do anything that is usual and regular in our routines, that we just take a moment to think about what is happening on the inside of us. What might the Holy Spirit be saying to us and our hearts and our consciences? Where do we need to be putting in those red lines so that we will continue following Jesus, making strides in our maturing in him, and be open to all of the wonderful things that God has planned for us if we give up the things which are going to stop us along the way? I encourage you to close your eyes as I read a well-known old hymn. Dare to be a Daniel. Dare to stand alone. Dare to have a purpose firm. Dare to make it known. Standing by a purpose true, heeding God's command. Honor them, the faithful few. All hail to Daniel's band. Many mighty men are lost, daring not to stand, who for God had been a host by joining Daniel's band. Many giants, great and tall, stalking through the land, headlong to the earth would fall if met by Daniel's band. Hold the gospel banner high, on to victory grand. Satan and his hosts defy and shout for Daniel's band. Dare to be a Daniel. Dare to stand alone. Dare to have a purpose firm. Dare to make it known. Amen.